Zimmerman, and this is The Resistance. Somewhere, Benjamin Franklin Bache and Matthew Lyon are saying, "I told you so." These men went to jail in this country under our Constitution for criticism. Bache was in New Media. Lyon was a congressman from the party that was not in power. They were guilty of criticizing the president and other media, which defended the president. And Mr. Bache and Congressman Lyon would remind us that we have previously completely and nearly fatally screwed up how to handle resistance. And they would remind us that the right to resist has been destroyed, and the country nearly destroyed with it, by better men than Donald John Trump. The man behind the jailing of Bache and Lyon and 20 or so other publishers, politicians, and citizens, one of whom for making a joke in public, the man Bache and Lyon opposed was President John Adams. That John Adams. Founding father John Adams. Even a man of the vision of John Adams could not see that demonizing dissent and criminalizing resistance could by themselves end democracy. The stains upon the Adams legacy were called the Alien and Sedition Acts. And they threatened jail for anyone daring to, quote, write, print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government. And 59 days before his inauguration, Trump and his mob are already clearly laying the groundwork for new criminalization of your right to publicly criticize, that which will begin on day one as the worst presidential administration in our history. Much has been made of the distraction Trump provided by tweeting petulantly about how the cast of Hamilton addressed the vice president-elect when he attended their performance last Friday. The criticism of the coverage paid is valid. The fighter pilots call this chaff, spraying strips of metal into the air to screw up radar. We spent a day talking about moron Trump's moronic tweets instead of his confession in everything but name to fraud accusations in the Trump University lawsuit. We spent another day talking about Hamilton and Pence instead of about Trump totally mixing the presidency with his businesses. We spent another day talking about disrespect and respect instead of yesterday's gaffe from Trump's voter repression expert, in which he walked into a meeting with Trump carrying a document easily readable in the photographs, laying out details of registries, religious tests for people entering this country, and defense against lawsuits. We spent several entire news cycles talking about actors and rap, and not about the anti-Semites, the racists, the fascists Trump is appointing to his White House, the Bannons and Giulianis and Sessions and their ilk. So scummy it led the great John Cleese to conclude that it looks as if Trump, quote, is assembling the crew for a pirate ship. A distraction? Yes. But that does not mean his seeming disbelief at the evidence that he is hated is not real and not important. Bluntly, if he or Pence cannot handle booing, they should get new jobs in a new country, because whether they hear it or not, they will be booed every day for the rest of their lives. And more importantly, that also does not mean Trump is not intending to create a 21st century version of the Alien and Sedition Acts of John Adams. A president elected by a minority of the voters has again made threats against those who criticize him or his administration to be, has again made threats against the First Amendment. Taken out of the context of the anti-democratic, anti-criticism snowball already beginning its descent in this country, the takeaways from his tweets, "this should not happen," and "apologize," would seem merely like more petulance from the man-baby-elect, and the complaint about lack of respect merely more amazing self-unawareness from President Pussy Grabber. But those tweets did not come in a vacuum. Before the election, Trump threatened to loosen up libel laws, singled out reporters by name to encourage abuse from the crowds at his rallies, promised to sue the New York Times, and an advisor criticized a TV host and tweeted, "Watch what happens to her after this election is over." The day after it was over, a contestant from one of his TV shows said of those who did not vote for him, quote, "Mr. Trump has a long memory, and we're keeping a list." Responding to criticism from Senate Minority Leader Reid, Trump's campaign manager Kellyanne Conway said he, quote, should be very careful about characterizing somebody in a legal sense. In a legal sense. 9 days after the election, a federal judge in San Antonio, swearing in hundreds of new American citizens, told them that Donald Trump, quote, will be your president, and if you do not like that, you need to go to another country. He then also lashed out against pro athletes who have not stood for the national anthem, then reportedly claimed his remarks were not political. If you would like to resist, by trying to get this judge ousted. His name is John Primomo, and he can be removed by the U.S. District Court. Or perhaps at least they can send him the copy of the Constitution he appears to lack. But of course, professional demonizing of dissent requires blaming the victim. Campaign manager Conway said dissent, anger, resistance, your resistance is the fault of the media. Most of the media did the world a disservice, she said, by not preparing them for the possibility of Donald Trump winning the presidency. It simply was not part of the conversation. So fascism isn't the problem. American media's reluctance to soften up the public to accept fascism, that's the problem. Which brings us back to the Alien and Sedition Acts, and a state senator in Washington named Doug Erickson, a loud Trump sycophant, another one of the banana Republicans, whom our friends, publisher Benjamin Franklin Bache and Congressman Matthew Lyon, would recognize immediately. I respect the right to protest, he said, but when it endangers people's lives and property, it goes too far. Fear, intimidation, and vandalism are not a legitimate form of political expression. Those who employ it must be called to account. Senator Erickson says he will propose a bill next year that would criminalize what he calls violent protesting, creating a new Class C felony, punishable by fines of up to $10,000 and or imprisonment of up to 5 years, crimes to be called economic terrorism. We're not just going to go after the people who commit these acts of terrorism, he continues, still digging. We are going after the people who fund them. Wealthy donors should not feel safe in disrupting middle-class jobs. The wealthy donors to whom Senator Erickson refers would also be liable for any economic loss caused by the assemblies, supposedly protected by the First Amendment, or as Erickson wants to now call those assemblies, economic terrorism. So, Trump's Twitter tantrum about how Pence was treated at a play about a vice president so incapable of handling criticism that he shot the former Secretary of the Treasury may have been a diversion, and it may have seemed trivial compared to the other nightmares with which we wake each morning now. But do not mistake them. They are preface to new alien and sedition acts, legal ones or merely cultural ones, to new demonizing of dissent, to, at best, chilling measures against your right to resist. And how do you resist laws designed to criminalize resistance? Happily, there is a method, tried and true, and you should prepare yourself for it. It worked in South Africa for Gandhi in 1908 when they tried to create a registry of people from India. It worked for Gandhi again decades later in India. It worked for the civil rights leaders here in the 1960s. If the laws come to pass, do not seek to evade them. Seek to break them. Have them broken so often by so many people that the jails cannot hold all of us and the infrastructure collapses with the government then begging for our help. Moreover, if resistance is denied us, the act of being arrested for resistance becomes resistance. Because we are not going back to the time of the Alien and Sedition Acts. Matthew Lyon and Benjamin Franklin Bache, and yes, he was Benjamin Franklin's favorite grandson, they are alive in our history. Even Adams and those who supported them had a kind of excuse. The country was barely 20 years old then. Trump and his mob have no excuse, no moral ground, no precedent, no right, and no chance of success. Come after our resistance, Trump, legally or culturally or both, and America will kick your ass.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Da-da-da-da. Carolina.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Vladimir Deese. And, this is another clip, quick segment. This one on fake news. Where's the documentary? You know, I was thinking this week, I was thinking it as I listened to people talk about, quote, fake news. Where's the documentary? Where are all the old occupiers who were running the media centers at New York and Philadelphia and all these other great spots? Where are they at? Why do I ask? Why? Because this documentary writes itself. But why don't I do it, you ask? Yeah, one, I don't have the direct equipment. But I'm not saying I may not do something. But right now, anyway. I only ask the question because it needs to be asked. And oftentimes, you put a question into the cosmos, and the cosmos won't answer you as in, well, here's where it's at. No. You ask a question like that, and the cosmos says, yes, this is needed. Boom. Bring it about. And people suddenly, without knowing you, get motivated to do something. Now, I warn you all, don't just try this to see if it works. Most of the problems of the world is because people don't understand that this actually does work. And they're just spouting stuff. You gotta have a clear mind and a clear heart in order to say something like that. So put your time into a little meditation. You know, do some cleansing. And then ask the question. See what happens. You will be surprised, though. Sometimes it comes back, kind of bites you and says, yes, where is it? You do it. But that's just sometimes. Most of the times, actually. But, you know, you'll figure that out. Anyway, back to the point at hand. Fake news. The documentary writes itself. In listening to everybody talk about, quote, fake news, you know, I was quite surprised. Actually, I wasn't really surprised. Because even a lot of the progressives and a lot of the individuals who consider themselves liberal, they lack a true knowledge of radical history. Chris Hedges, who I do like, I think is a quintessential example of this. Not a quintessential example of it, but he does somewhat demonstrate it, because he's a rich man, or at least he grew up very privileged. And Chris Hedges understands a lot more about the wealthy and the elite than he leads on. He does. And he could easily, if Chris Hedges wanted to, he could sit down. He's a writer. So I know he can do this. If he wanted to over the next year, he could sit down and he can write a scathing, behind-the-scenes, 2,000-page book revealing some of the most incredible secrets attached to the wealthy. Why? Why do I say this? Now this, you know, Chris Hedges could get and be absolutely beside himself about this. And I think he has a little bit of right to say it. But I'm gonna say this. John Taylor Gatto, who, like Chris Hedges, grew up he didn't grow up privileged, but he moved into that arena. He moved into that area where he was around a lot of privileged people. And he wrote a book called The Underground History of Public Education. And what I realized, now when I first listened to the book, I listened to it, not read it. This was about 5 years ago. I loved it. It was amazing. It was a great story. But I listened to it again, a lot of it, recently. And between the first time when I listened to it and now, I have learned so much about the information that the wealthy deals with, the information that they're taught with, that I understood a lot more of what he was saying. Not necessarily, oh, well, you know, I know about that situation in depth, but I knew where how he got some of the references and why these references were not readily available and known. The wealthy have their own set of libraries. They have their own set of materials. Particularly, they have a schooling system which builds the foundations for their young in a very different way than people like me, who are actually down on the economic ladder, than those schools build for me. You know, those, and this was designed, you read the book, actually, you'll see, this was very much designed. And so, what Mr. Gatto was laying out was how that information, or excuse me, what he was laying out was the story that most of us don't know because we don't have access to the books that they do. Don't kid yourself. If you are not wealthy, particularly if you, let's say most of us are making, you know, less than $35,000. Most of us actually are making less than $30,000. So if you are in that $25,000 and below area, these people are not reading the same books you were reading when they were in high school. And actually, if you go to a really good suburban school, and actually I think just most suburban schools, the books that they read are a lot different than the books that are being given to the inner city kids, that are being given to the rural kids. These are very different. These books are very, very different. The books that they study are meant to give them more of a, quote, liberal education. But even now, Chris Hedges points this out. And this is one of the primary reasons how I started to see how he was leaving a lot of stuff out that he could just absolutely, if he wanted to, he can lay waste to a lot of these people. But in many instances, I don't know if he can get it published, or if he just says, you know, it's not worth the hassle. But he even pointed out that there is a education mechanism in this country which prepares people to be systems managers. And between him, John Kozol, and, well, just really common sense, and John Taylor Gatto, they all point to the fact that rich kids go to school to learn how to be in power. To learn how to be in power. Whereas people on the bottom learn how to take orders. That's what we do. That's what we do. And then the people in the middle are the systems managers. They go for various system management jobs. They are the, quote, directors and managers and what have you. That's what they do. So, if you grow up in that upper echelons, or if you move into that upper echelons, and you have an ability to read and to write, then you can actually put, you can put two and two together very rapidly and start to build a story that most people have no clue exists. And John Telegatto, in the introduction to the Secret History of Public Education, he says something which, you know, again, 5 years ago, I believed. He says that he said, I'm not going to include a host of a large bibliography so you don't get lost in the footnotes. Well, what he was actually saying, and again, this is something that I just recently, over the last year, year and a half, learned, was that there are books, just like there are educational tiers in the society, that are meant for certain classes of people. So in his book, in The Secret History of Public Education, and you can get an incredibly well done audiobook version of it, from Lynn, L-Y-N, Gary, G-E-R-R-Y. In his book, he talks about Arianism and the connection of Arianism to the thinking processes and the motivating processes of public education. Now, he doesn't talk a whole heap and a lot about it, but having done a little bit of reading on Arianism, and I'm talking about the mythology of Arianism, there are books, and I couldn't find some of the references that he made, but I've heard this with other lecturers who admit there are books that are not meant for people outside of the upper class, and so you don't list them in a bibliography. There has been times, and I know this has happened to you, when I was reading a book, and I've come across something so profound, and yet it's not referenced. Or I'll come across a couple of incredibly powerful passages, and they will not be referenced. And I think to myself, how did the person come up with that? Now, there's some other books that I've been reading which are a little bit different. They're not necessarily what you call academic, but I've been seeing some of that information, or at least the building blocks of that information, from these other books. So that's another one. I'll give you a great starting point, two great starting points actually. Jung, very big, and then the Kabbalah, which is, again, both of these, you look at them and you go, are you serious? This has nothing to do with, but when you start to read them, even if you glance through them, you don't even have to read them all the way through. Even when you glance through them, you'll start to see small itty-bitty connections. Now, to fake news, this is, all of this I'm using to preference the information on fake news. We have, if you actually think about it, since we have the three tiers, and I want you to really honestly think about this, we have the three tiers of education. We have the three tiers of literary pieces that are available to the masses. And when I say the masses, I mean the masses of the people who are in those tiers. Your largest group of people are going to be where? The bottom of your society. That's going to be where the largest group of your people is going to be. So that means the smallest group, which is going to be those at the top, have to devise a way of making the people at the bottom believe that they have all of the wisdom and knowledge in the world at their fingertips. So what do they do? Well, I'm going to reference a Simpsons episode here. I'm a big Simpsons fan, and trust me, you listen to this, you will know I reference The Simpsons. I sometimes reference American Dad. I don't watch a lot of TV. Recently, I started watching a very good series from Amazon called The Man in the High Castle. Somewhat amazing. I'm only about a quarter of the way through the first season, but it's so far really good. But The Simpsons, a couple of seasons ago, produced this episode called The Book Job. And it received very little attention. Me personally, I've watched it about 20 times. And I'm amazed at the concept behind it. What this show portends, what it actually suggests, if it doesn't outright imply, is that a lot of the books that are on the, quote, teen top seller lists are manufactured by these book publishers who hire young literary students, or in some cases, not so young literary students, at penny prices to write these books, to churn them out quickly, and then they use the profile of a fake author to, you know, give the impression that that it's one person writing. And they bought up a couple of people. They bought up J.K. Rowling, and they bought up Stephen King. Now, whether or not you want to believe it, as soon as I heard that, first and foremost, it's not that far-fetched to me. They do this in the intelligence community. They do it in the military community. Whenever they want to write propaganda, they do it. So this wouldn't surprise me if they did this. In fact, it would make sense. Why? Because if you watch television, particularly if you watch hour-long dramas, but it really doesn't matter. If you watch television, then you know, you have huge writing staffs that are churning out these episodes. You know that. So if you have 22 episodes of a sitcom being written by 10, 20, or 30 people sometimes, and yet it seems far-fetched to have 10, 20, or 30 people writing 500, 600, 700 page books, which come out every year or year and a half, which, if you think about it, the 500, 600, 700, 800 page book is just like a season of television refined and condensed into written format. If that seems impossible to you, then me and you are definitely living in two different realities, because that seems utterly, utterly, utterly possible. Not only does it seem possible, moving back to the propaganda aspect of it, if you wanted to trick people into believing that they had all the information at their fingertips, that not only seems possible, that seems logical. It seems logical. Most of the books that people will ever read have nothing to do with life. It never explains anything to have to do with life, and it's a good form of escape. Now, of course, most people will say, well, what's wrong with escaping? I'm not saying there's something wrong with escaping. I read sometimes to escape. And heck, reading is supposed to be for enjoyment. You're not supposed to always get intellectual stimulation from it. In fact, it's quite weird, but if you go back, and I got this from John Taylor Gatto's book, and Gatto, by the way, is G-A-T-T-O, G-A-T-T-O. If you read some of the original versions of some of the books, which we know today, like Huck Finn, there's one that Chris Hedges references constantly about the Moby Dick, and some of the others, and you actually get an unedited version from back in the 1800s, you see really quickly that even when they were reading for enjoyment, their reading was thick. It was thick. And that also goes to talk about the idea of dumbing us down. That goes to, you know, into talking about dumbing us down in the fact that when you were taught to read, you were taught how to read. In various ways, actually, many people could teach themselves how to read, as Gatto points out. But speed reading was important. Speed reading was important. I once had somebody ask me the question, how the heck was it that people in the old days used to sit down and read for hours on end? Well, it's simple. They weren't reading hours on end. They were sitting down and finishing a 300-400 page book if they had the time to do it and they, you know, didn't have to work all day. But even then, as was pointed out, it seems most people were pretty literate back in them days, you know, 300 years ago. But their speed reading enabled them to flash through a couple hundred pages and analyze it and memorize it in an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. So imagine sitting down and flashing through a Harry Potter's book in 4 hours and enjoying it thoroughly, remembering every word, remembering where you've seen and read certain portions of the book, on what page, on how each page began. I mean, imagine this. This is what they used to do. Again, though, back to the propaganda. That is part of the dumbing down process. Now, fake news, how fake news fits into this is 100 years ago the government, and I say government actually, and I backtrack that because it wasn't the government, it was the bankers. The bankers wanted the government to convince the American people that World War I was in the American people's best interest. When they wanted that to occur, the government, the actual government this time, put together a propaganda arm which went to work on the American public opinion of Germany. And indeed, that continued after the war. There's a documentary, I've mentioned it before, The Century of Self, which kind of touches on this, when propaganda went commercial. And what you realize is most commercials are just baser instinct lies. Lies. I mean, they don't talk about the products. They don't talk about anything, but they want to either make you laugh or make you not think and then just go out, run out, and buy the stuff. And that's what they are. Well, this was really the beginning of fake news. And it was put out by the government at the behest of the wealthy bankers. During the 60s, not even during the 60s, during the 40s, into the 50s, into the 60s, the government kept doing that. This time, though, it was on the Reds, it was on the Radicals, it was on the Socialists, the Social Workers. It was on the people who were going to make it hard for capitalism to move into the consumer realm, the people who were going to tell the truth. And this hasn't stopped today. So to hear people talk about fake news as being promoted by Facebook, which is a social utility site, it is not a social networking site anymore. The language has changed. It is a social utility site, meaning you have a lot less freedoms on there than you think. Since Facebook's owner, Mr. Zuckerberg, has been routinely outed and connected to what people call secret societies, but also apparently the defense and intelligence apparatus in this country, it shouldn't surprise you. It shouldn't surprise you that fake news played a role in any of this. Not only should it not surprise you that fake news played a role in any of this, there's a whole news network called Fox News, which all it does is peddle fake news and outrage. Not to say MSNBC does any better, but my God, it's so blatant on Fox. People have been conditioned all their lives. Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, you name them on the right. All they are alarmists and fake news propagandists. And yet people are surprised that fake news took off. Some years ago, I listened to another great audiobook called The Republican Noise Machine. And what you realized from reading that book, especially from its comprehensive history, its comprehensive history of the takeover by conservative groups of media sites, association, civic groups, things like that, what you realize is that they did this, and I truthfully believe the government, particularly the right-wing side of the government, had a huge, huge influence in this, but they did it by using manipulation and false propaganda. We say propaganda, but a lot of the times we're talking just about lies. We're talking about we're talking about fake news. And you see it a lot in the newspapers. You see it a lot on the internet. It's to the point where, look, no major media system has hands clean. Do not ever forget the CIA. Do not ever forget the CIA said back in the mid-70s. It said back in the mid-70s during the Church hearings, which, by the way, it's kind of funny. You can find just about everything you want on the internet, but you cannot find the complete Church hearings. And you cannot find the complete Iran-Contra hearings. You might be able to now find the Iran-Contra on C-SPAN. I haven't looked there. But how is it that you cannot find those online? They are two of the largest, most important hearings in this country's history. Bar none. Bar none. The third might be, which, of course, unfortunately, they didn't have, they didn't have them cheaply available. They didn't have cameras back then. But the third might be not the inquiry into 9/11. Of course, they had cameras then. Not the inquiry into what happened at Pearl Harbor. But, and I don't know what it's called, actually, there was a brief investigation of an attempt to actually overthrow the president of the United States in the 1930s. General Smedley Butler talked about this, and he was one of the chief witnesses to this, because he was approached to take the role of dictator. But that might be the third. Anyway, the CIA admitted in the 1970s that it had, during the Church hearings, it had operatives who planted false stories created by the agency. This is not made up, ladies and gentlemen. This is not conspiracy theory, ladies and gentlemen. This came from the CIA directly. They said they had propagandist agents infiltrating every single newsroom, news organization. He might have been a little bit over-exaggerating then, but I don't believe he's over-exaggerating today. I also don't believe they really need to do it. They have a whole host of people who's willing to do it. But the CIA said, we have a host of people. We have people in every single news outlet in this country, written and visual, who can project stories that we want in there. Now, when I heard this, I automatically went back to Dr. King, because I go back to Dr. King with a lot of things. It explains a lot of what happened with him. The last year of his life, he was smeared everywhere. That was the CIA. Well, if they were doing that in the 1970s, and in fact, I was listening to an interview on one of my podcasts, and a man who wrote a book on Tupac Shakur and his death talked about him trying to actually get a very important, looking back historically now, article which he wrote on Tupac's entourage and how so many of them were connected. I don't want to say to law enforcement, but there were some strange connections to these people, and he tried getting it published in one of the nation's leading alternative media sites, and he was stopped by an editor or an editor's assistant who later on went to be known as a very, very rigid conservative individual and was kind of outed as a military asset. And so, again, if they were doing this back in the 70s, why do you think they are having a ball with the internet? On top of this, and this is actually why I went through this whole charade with you, or this whole this whole conversation with you. Back in 2014, when Michael Brown's death had caused people to start saying, you know, enough is enough. We need to be done with this. Less march, less protest. A man posted on YouTube, and sounded like a white kid, actually. He posted on YouTube him scrolling past all of these Twitter feeds, which were tweeting out the same tweet. It said, Michael Brown was a thug who got what he deserved. Now, this has stuck with me because, one, he pointed out very quickly, goes, look at the people's profiles that are here. They're beautiful. They're sexy. You think you're getting these people who are, you know, good-looking so-and-sos, when in fact, you're just getting propagandists. You're getting what we used to call bots, some people call trolls now. I think they need to really reassess that. They're bots. You're getting robots that are just spouting information that a propagandist wants you to see. And this has stuck with me because I've seen things on Facebook particularly where individuals will engage with me or other people, and you can see they are not trolling them, which I understand where the term comes from, but what they're doing is, one, they're pumping them for information. Two, they're trying to project a certain mindset. And three, when that fails, what usually happens is people see drop-off in the availability of their posts, and this is what a propagandist wants to do. This is what they want to do. They want to try to change your mind to conform to what they want you to think, and then if that doesn't work, then they're just going to put you in jail. So fake news is a part of that. If you start to think that fake news is real news, and it's hard to tell sometimes. Oh my God, is it hard to tell. Now, South Park a year ago, man, the last season of South Park, not the one that's currently going on, but the previous one, it was accurate, man. It was so accurate. It was scary. But they did an episode on the media. And they talked about, the whole season was how ads have become human, and it's fascinating, actually, to go back and watch it, and people should go back and watch it, but that's kind of what you're seeing here now. You're seeing people posing as humans, giving you ads, and the ads that they're giving you is fake news. Now, in the South Park episode, they just talked about sponsored content. But the sponsored content has gone kind of human now. The ads have gone human. It would do you some very good, it would do you just very good, I guess, when, talking too quickly, it would do you very well if you were to go and look up the word advertisement. Now, over in England, they don't pronounce it advertisement. They pronounce it advertisement. They don't emphasize the ad. They emphasize the vert. There's a reason for that, which you should go and find out. This is how you protect yourself, ladies and gentlemen. Before I step away from this section, this is how you protect yourself. You understand that the model of human relation is language. This is why they have to dumb you down when it comes to it. This is why they have to put forward things. They have to put forward things that you will lust after, even though it's bad for you. Because you do not know the meaning of it. Don't forget, everything, every word that you hear has a virtual meaning, which is how your mind, your subconscious mind, actually deals with the word. And it has a virtual meaning, or not a virtual, a what I like to call a tangible reason. It is what the forefront of your mind says, and that's how you act. Now, I know there's probably two words actually for that. I can't think of them right now, but that's what it is. We are shown things every day that corrupts our thinking, and we don't understand it because we don't know words. We don't understand the words that we are seeing. I'll give you just one example, and then I'm going to actually end this segment. Ariana Grande. Most people know who she is. Whether or not you like her, I don't care. Do you understand every time they say that word, or that name, do you understand every time you see it? Do you understand every time you see her, your mind automatically associates her with that name, right? You say, okay, that is Ariana Grande. And by the way, I will not do that very often where I say right. Drives me crazy. Anyway, Ariana Grande, you look at the name, and what is it? What does it actually say? Ariana Grande is a feminine version, a feminized version of what? Ariana means Aryan. And Grande means grand. Ariana Grande is a feminized version of Aryan and grand. Or if you were in Spanish class, you might just swap the two words and it would mean what? Grand Aryan. You don't understand what is before you because you don't understand words. The same goes with Melania Trump. Melania is a feminized version of the word melanin. Melanin Trump. Understand what you're seeing. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate you listening. You guys have been amazing to me recently as I've been trying to get back to doing this. You have shown a lot of support. I want you to definitely keep it up. Let me know what you want to hear about, and I'll see what I can do. All right? Again, this is your brother, Vymir Adis. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again.
the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are